Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. For blogger and author Heather Armstrong, life seemed perfect, at least on her popular mommy blog, Deuce. She presented as the picture of modern motherhood to her legions of readers. Then she found herself in the depths of depression she couldn't shake. In her book, The Valedictorian of Being Dead, Heather shares the lengths she'd go to battle her hopelessness. She says living a very public life while dealing with despair was surreal.
I think it was the expectation from my audience saying, well, you know, you've shared all of this, now you need to share everything else. And it wasn't what I wanted to share, and it was my own story that I wanted to keep secret, and people were very angry at me, and they took that anger out on me because I wouldn't talk about it.
That must have been really tough to deal with, having to deal with all that anger.
To read about your divorce on the New York Times or the Huffington Post and the local newspaper is really strange.
Yeah, really surreal, I imagine. On your darkest days, what kinds of thoughts were running through your mind?
I was on, I called it the hamster wheel, where I was doing everything over and over and over and over again with no end in sight and no joy and no reward and no happiness. And although I loved my children, I felt like what I was doing is providing basic needs, and I felt helpless because I couldn't keep up with it all.
Did your thoughts get dark enough that you were ever thinking about suicide?
I had suicidal thoughts in the sense that I just wanted to be dead. Mm. I never planned anything, and I never had a way in mind of doing. Of ending my life, mm-hmm. but I just really longed for the lack of my senses, for like a sense of nothingness. Mm-hmm. But there was one moment that overcame me and scared me so badly, and that's when I called my mother.
Yeah, can you tell me about that moment?
Well, so I had been calling my mother almost nightly for 18 months and just sort of screaming into the phone that I just couldn't keep up anymore, and it just went on and on and on. And then there was this moment where I had been dating in Utah for 6 months, which is, Utah is a beautiful backdrop for a suicidal ideation, is what I write. Mm-hmm. This person left my house in a fit, and I remember falling to the floor and feeling a very dark feeling overcome me. Mm-hmm. And that dark feeling was so scary that I knew I needed to reach out to someone.
Mm-hmm. So you reached out to your mom.
And I did.
Yeah, and then what happened? What did you tell her, and what did she do?
I just started howling and wailing into the phone, and she knew with the tone in my voice that she needed to drive to my house. And so she said, you're going to stay on the phone with me, and you're going to be there when I get there, and I'm going to talk to you the whole time. And so I stayed on the phone, and when I answered the door, she was on the phone, and I was on the phone.
And wasn't it her idea, wasn't one of the things she said the next morning that she forced you to make an appointment with your psychiatrist?
She did force me. I needed to get a refill on a prescription, but I was very afraid to see my psychiatrist because I was afraid that he might commit me, which was a very scary thought. Because I didn't want to lose custody of my kids. And I sat down across from him, and he looked at me and just shook his head. He says, you don't have to say a word. I know exactly what you're feeling. The depression has stolen your eyes. Uh-huh. And he came back over and he said, listen, you know I run the ECT clinic, which is electroconvulsive therapy. And what we're doing is trying to replicate the effects of ECT without the side effects, which are permanent memory loss, migraines, and other sorts of maladies that can occur when you get ECT. Mm-hmm. And we can do that through anesthesia, which has no side effects. And they have decided to use propofol to take the brain down to a certain, basically, I called it a flat line, but it really is sort of a flat line because it goes down to a flat line, then there's a burst, a flat line and a burst, and it's called burst suppression.
Can you take me through the first treatment?
Yeah, we walked into the clinic and I filled out a piece of paperwork that asked me all sorts of questions about how I felt about myself and about life. And I wanted to throw that piece of paper in the garbage because I was like, I don't want to tell them. Yeah. I don't want to write about this.
Yeah.
I feel terrible about myself. And they, you know, and then there's a needle that they have to stick in your arm. And they were getting used to the needle, which is much larger than the normal needle that they use for ECT. And then we would sit in the waiting room until they called me in. Mm-hmm. And they'd walk me over to a gurney, affix a wire to my forehead, and then they'd shove me the propofol. And they would stick me under. And unfortunately, the first time that they put me under, they also gave me fentanyl, which apparently I'm allergic to.
Oh, dear.
So I had a very, very bad hallucination going under. Oh, yeah.
Here come the pains. Can you tell me just a bit about the hallucination? What did you imagine that you were seeing?
Immediately they said that you should be able to feel the fentanyl right now. And as they said that, their voices melted and then the walls started melting.
Oh, wow.
And then the room started melting and then everybody in the room turned into a monster and like they were about to attack me and eat me.
Ooh.
It was not a good trip.
No. How long were you out for?
So I went down and they kept me at the burst suppression state for about 15 to 18 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they waited for me to come back up. And that first time, it took almost 2 hours for me to come back up.
Oh, wow.
And they have to get me to a point where I'm breathing again. And, of course, my mother is watching this whole thing happen. And she's waiting, waiting, waiting. Is she going to breathe? Is she going to breathe?
Yeah.
So it was harrowing for her.
So how did you feel when you after those 2 hours, when you came back up? How did you feel?
I had a terrible, terrible headache. A searing, searing headache from the fentanyl. And I was very discouraged. I thought, okay, this is not going to work. There's no way I can do this. I can't live like this. And so we went back to them the second time and said, can we not use that?
Mm.
So they were able to take that out of the dosage.
Okay, and so that made a difference. You didn't
yes.
hallucinate. You didn't get bad headaches. And I would,
exactly.
And was it also the case that they didn't have as much trouble bringing you back?
Exactly.
Yeah. Your mother, yeah. You mentioned about your mother watching you that first time and waiting for you to start breathing again and 2 hours. That must have been just really excruciating. Your mother and stepfather accompanied you to every treatment. What did they tell you about what it was like to watch you going through this 10 times in less than a month?
It was so much harder on my mother than it was on me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was extraordinarily harrowing for my mother to watch it every single time. And my mother never sat down. My mother never sat down during the entire time I was out.
Wow.
She watched and watched, and she would talk to the doctors and she would talk to the nurses and take notes and take pictures. And she's the star of the book. She's the star of the whole story.
Mm.
She is, people tell me that if it was made into a movie, she would be the leading role.
When did you realize that the treatment was working?
Well, sometimes when you're depressed, you don't realize you're feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think I was feeling better, but I had started to shower.
Yeah.
I had started to put on makeup after the second or third treatment. I had started to put on clean clothes. And then after the fifth treatment, I came home and I didn't feel drowsy or groggy. And I experienced music and light and color in a way that I had not ever experienced before.
Oh,
almost
really?
Almost like I had been reborn.
Oh, yeah. Wow. So even you'd never even experienced this even before this major depressive episode.
It was so much deeper and richer and full of just contrast. And it was such a remarkable change that I really did have the idea in my head, like, I can't believe that I could have possibly wanted to be dead yesterday.
Wow. And then you continued to feel that way through the remaining five treatments?
Yeah. And I was scared that maybe the treatment would reverse what I had just experienced. And he's like, no, this is only supposed to get better with each, you know, continuing treatment. And when it was over, I was just gloriously happy.
That's wonderful.
And remain so.
That's
yeah.
great, yeah. After you completed all 10 sessions, you found out something interesting about the medical staff who had treated you. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, so it turns out that this is a clinical trial, and they had literally no money going into this initial 10 people. And so all of the people at the clinic were donating their time.
Wow.
They were staying after for however long it took me to wake up out of that anesthesia and giving me themselves to get me better. And I am forever indebted to those people who donated their time to my mental health.
You interviewed Dr. Mickey after the treatment. Was he able to explain to you how the treatment worked?
Yeah, so the idea, there was a study done in Austria in the early 1990s, and they thought, okay, they studied ECT, and they realized that in ECT, they shock the brain to a seizure, and the seizure can cause a flat line in the brain, a temporary flat line for a couple of minutes. And that flat line is what sort of reboots the computer of the brain.
Mm.
And they did a study that found out if you didn't have the flat line after the seizure, you didn't get any benefit from the ECT. And then they thought, well, what if we could, you can do this with anesthesia, why not try that?
Mm-hmm.
So they did a study with anesthesia and achieved the same results. And so the staff and the community, the medical community in Utah is incredible. And they are looking for ways always to improve mental health especially. And they looked into this and thought, why are we not pursuing this?
Mm.
So this is like one of the primary, it's only being done here in the world.
Mm.
It's being done here at the University
oh, wow.
of Utah.
Yeah. How has the treatment worked for the other people who have received it?
So this is 10 people, and they came up with the study, and this is the first time propofol has ever been used this way. And they just had this idea, well, propofol can cause this in the brain, burst suppression. And of the 10, 6 of us experienced positive results.
That's great.
Which is remarkable for, you know, something they just came up with.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's been 2 years. And, you know, I have my bad days,
mm-hmm.
of course, and I have my anxious moments. But my brain is now at a point where I can recognize that it's just an anxious moment. It's a bad day.
That's fantastic.
It's not the end of the world.
What do you want readers to get out of your book, The Valedictorian of Being Dead?
I want people to have the words that they may not be able to come up with themselves,
mm-hmm.
to explain to other people, this is what it feels like to be anxious. This is what it feels like to be depressed. This is what is going through my head. Please understand and please believe me. And for people who aren't depressed, who aren't anxious, to understand, oh, this is what my wife is going through. This is what my daughter is going through. I wanted to give words to people who didn't have them.
Mm, yeah. And what did you get out of writing your memoir?
I really wanted to write a book because I wanted to bring attention to this study. I didn't think a blog post or a magazine article would do it. I think people needed something in their hands to hold. And for me, it gave me a new purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
I really do believe that my calling is to bring awareness and to bring a voice to this so that other people feel safer talking and reaching out about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How has it changed your relationship with your daughters, Lita and Marlo, and your mother and stepfather and your siblings?
We have really grown close as a family, and you know, a lot of the grandchildren suffer, and I think what I have done is given my brother and sister hope for their kids.
Mm-hmm.
And my two daughters, they wanted me to be happy. That's really all they wanted, was to see me happy again, and we're so happy that I returned to them in clean clothes.
Yeah.
And and we have very, very open and frank conversations about anxiety and sadness and bad days.
Mm.
So
suicide is a pretty big public health problem in Utah. Do you have any thoughts about why that's the case?
It's a huge health problem.
Yeah.
I think we have one of the highest teen suicide rates in the country, if not the highest. My brother's son went to a high school last year that had 6 suicides.
Wow.
Yeah. And they do a lot of research into like the fact that altitude has a problem with exacerbating depression. But I think that the research should probably go more into social media.
Mm-hmm.
And should go into cultural pressure, religious pressure. A lot of it is that these kids are trying to live up to a standard that they feel like they can't meet.
Mm.
And this is a phenomenon. This is a tragedy that we have to address.
Heather Armstrong is the creator of the popular blog Deuce and author of The Valedictorian of Being Dead. You can find out more about Heather at wpr.org/beta.